people when I was growing up called me Mander. They'd get rid of the A and add an R. And
that's typical of the land out here in the east, opposite west.
The beast?
It's in the beast of the east.
Welcome to episode 105 of Great Beer Adventure. I am here today with a crap ton of people, including Heidi Geist.
So many people.
We're at the summer session of the Maine Brewers Guild, and there are a lot of people here.
There's probably 2,000 or 3,000 people here right now.
I think there's like 80-something breweries here today.
Are there really? Holy moly. There's some great breweries, actually. I think I've made my rounds. I'm maybe missing two at this point.
That's a lot.
Maybe I'm lying, actually. 80-something. Yeah, no, I haven't had that many beers. Gosh, darn it.
You've missed a few, I think.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to go back around.
So while you've been drinking beers, I've been talking to people. And I have actually been asking them what the hardest thing about opening a brewery has been for them. So let's take a quick little break from you and me chatting here at this festival and listen to what they have to say. Okay?
Let's do it.
My name's Lee Margolin. This is the Pennisawassee Brewing Company. All the licenses. I have 5 different licenses / permits. Not for me personally, because I come from the medical device industry and regulatory affairs. So I had experience with getting medical devices cleared by the FDA, but I know lots of my colleagues find the regulatory overhead a hurdle that's really hard to overcome, and it discourages a lot of people from moving into the professional area. But, you know, for me, it was kind of another day at the office.
So, hi, I'm Mary Weber from Monhegan Brewing. The hardest part of opening a brewery is all the things that you don't think about that aren't related to beer, like trash removal and who's gonna clean the bathrooms.
And you can go into more because you're on an island, so trash removal is more than just removing the trash.
Totally, it's really expensive too. And basically it's us carting $10 trash bags full of stuff up to the ball field.
I'm Elizabeth Johnston from Lake St. George Brewing Company, and for us, the hardest part of opening a brewery that just opened a week ago was that we had to balance the really great ideas and the wants and the passion with the practical and what makes sense for a startup brewery, and we had 6 of us who had to agree on all of those needs, so that was challenging.
Hey, my name is Mike Anderson. I'm the brewer and the owner of Penobscot Bay Brewery. I think the hardest thing is not so much opening it as being consistent in what you're making. I have a lot of younger guys that come and say, oh, I made this beer and it's really good and my friends want me to open a brewery. I said, well, go home and make it 20 times. You know, because it's the consistency is the hardest thing. Other than that, I mean, sometimes equipment's hard to find, dealing with the state, you know, regulations and trying to get that all sorted out. Opening isn't all that terrible. Controlling growth is probably the biggest problem that anyone will have because you can outgrow yourself so quickly. And you have to be able to keep up that consistent product day in and day out and then slowly build. You have to build at your own pace. You get too big too quick, you can't get the product out. It doesn't meet the mark anymore. As soon as you can't get the product out, restaurants that were carrying you no longer will even talk to you because they put you on the menu and now it's not available. You know, wholesalers want something there consistently. I think once you get going, maybe one of the worst mistakes you can make or mistake you could make would be to go to a wholesaler and say, oh, I've got these 10 beers. You should go. Just go to them and say, I've got these 3 beers. You know, and then stick with those and make the other ones to sell for yourself. Because, you know, honestly, there's probably a lot of your beers that you're making that do pretty good in your pub or your out of your tap house. But the wholesalers are never going to buy them. Just so much beer out there. Can't hard slice up the pie.
I think getting it all done. There's a lot to do. Yeah. And we started as a, you know, I've started as a one-man show. So for me, the hardest thing was getting it all done, like doing everything, the getting the permits, getting licensed, building a small building, which we did on our property when we first opened up a brewery. It's at our house, which is kind of cool because I can walk to and from work. It's changed a lot since then, but you know, I had friends help me build the building. I scraped together my savings to buy the first set of equipment that we had, and you know, it just took a while, even like for a really small operation. By the time I was licensed and making beer, it was probably about a year and a half from when we started to say, okay, let's give it a shot and turn this homebrewing hobby into a business and see if it'll work. And it, oh my gosh, we haven't looked back since then. This is Sean Lawson with Lawson's Finest Liquids. You have to ask that first. You have to say, okay, say your name, what brewery are you with, and then throw me your one question.
Right. Yeah. I get too excited about the story, though, because you are a beer brewing legend. When did you open?
2008. Yeah, January of 2008, we got licensed, and then the first batch of beer was ready in March. So made my grandmother, my grandmother from Belfast, Ireland. She came over on a boat when she was a wee lassie, just a mere 16 years old. And St. Paddy's Day, we tapped our very first keg up at Mad River Glen at the ski area. That's always been a place that is near and dear to my heart and is right in our wheelhouse in our community. It's a ski area that I work at part-time. During the winter, I still lead snowshoe tours there. I've been doing that for 20 plus years, and it's part of our lifestyle for sure. So we tapped the very first keg there at Mad River Glen in 2008, and here we are, fast forward to 2017, and we've added, you know, we've grown our small brewery in Warren, and then we followed a business model to launch our much bigger production with contract brewing down at Two Roads, and alternating proprietorship is what we do at, now at Two Roads. So we're, you know, we're the licensed brewer at the Stratford, Connecticut facility where Two Roads is located, and that's where we produce our Sip of Sunshine and Super Session beers, our flagships that people are just loving up. And we just landed here in Portland with Sip of Sunshine this week, and apparently people are going bananas for it, so we love it. The line here at the festival is amazing. What a reception. I'm so honored, humbled too. You know, it's awesome.
So it seems like there's a few themes going on there. I'm not going to talk about them right now because I've had too much beer to talk about that.
I'm supposed to say something.
And you're supposed to say something, and you didn't. I don't know what to do to say.
We're talking about the challenges of opening a brewery? Isn't that what our last episode was about?
No, we're doing a series right now on opening breweries.
No, it's a great series.
And so
it's helpful. It's going to be very helpful. All these people listening who are like, gosh dang it, I need to open a brewery. What does Amanda have to say?
Right. You know? Last week we talked about paperwork.
Yeah.
So far this week we've talked about the challenges.
We need to lively them up. And at a beer festival, you know, like, there is no such thing as people falling asleep. Oh, hey.
You know what that means, right?
We proved that.
People, somebody broke a glass somewhere.
And how is it like a universal thing that everybody cheers? Like everyone knows that they have to say something, like it's a celebration or something.
Right, but you are a mess up. Oh.
Yeah. I feel like 50 people just kind of did that at the same time. It's interesting. Human nature, human behavior.
The other thing I want to go and look at today is actually choosing the equipment and the different pieces and parts you're going to use within your brewery. So we're going to actually talk to Foulmouthed, who I did a collaboration beer with. So let's go and listen to that little piece right now.
Oh, Foulmouthed, we love you.
I am standing at an open garage door at Foulmouthed Brewing Company in South Portland, and we have been brewing this morning, and I'm standing here with Craig. Craig, thank you so much for joining me on the microphone and letting me come in and brew with you.
Pleasure to have you.
And we are going to be talking about, we're second part of our startup series. We're going to be talking about equipment and ingredients and the choices you made and why you made them. Sound good?
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, so you guys are now a year old, right?
Yes, yep, just a little over a year.
And so it wasn't too long ago where you actually had to start making some of these decisions about who you were going to get your equipment from and what kind of equipment you were going to do. Did you start, I don't even know how many fermentation vessels you have in here. How many do you have?
We have 4 fermentation vessels and 7 serving tanks.
Wow, that's a lot of serving tanks.
Yes.
Did you start with that many pieces of stainless?
Yeah, the only thing that we've added since we opened was our 1 Grundy tank, which is just a single-walled, cheap stainless vessel that we use as a bottling tank and funk tank.
A funk tank?
Yeah.
Seems like a technical term.
It is not a technical term. It is basically we're using it for the... All of our bottled beers tend to be with Brettanomyces or some other funky wild yeast strains, really high alcohol, specialty project kind of bottling system. And we still fill our bottles, meaning they're bottle conditioned, and we needed to have a mixing tank in order to add the priming sugar that will then be the source of carbonation for the beer. And that required a extra vessel and one that we weren't afraid to let get a little funky.
So yeah, so the Brett and stuff, they can take over, I've heard, a brewery.
Yeah, we are very careful to segregate the two sides of the brewery from the barrel projects and the things that are funky, and once it sort of moves its way over there, all of the tools remain separate.
So when you were originally thinking about putting this place together and the setup of it, I said garage door, but this used to be a garage, correct?
Yeah, this was an old auto shop, R&C Body and Speed, back in the, 50s.
Right, and did it sit empty all those years?
It closed, I think, in the 70s, mm-hmm. and sat empty for a while, and then the guy who lived next door bought the property and really just used it as a junk storage until now.
So you guys came in and you set up your space in a very specific way for what you needed. Can you talk a little bit about that process and how you decided what was going to go where? And
a lot of it was just about function. We could have done a few things to sort of make it prettier. We could have put the brew house so it was facing the garage door and so you could see it from outside. But we instead sort of focused on just making it an efficient space within to work and produce beer. So we positioned the brew house so the grain outdoor, where we're pulling all the grain out at the end of a brew day, is near the garage bay. So we don't have far to travel like that. And then the floor space in front of the garage bay is just sort of a big open area where we do our shipping and receiving through there.
So how did you decide where you're going to actually source your tanks from? Are they new to you or new in general?
We unfortunately didn't have any luck finding used equipment. We weren't opposed to it in any way, but the market on used equipment is popular right now as the craft beer industry is exploding. So we went with new tanks from American Beer Equipment in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Lincoln, Nebraska. So how long since when you decided these are the pieces that we needed and you put your order in, first off, did they help you in any way with that or was it all you?
No, they helped us quite a bit along the way, just sort of conversing about what the different components were going to be and how we would be arranging it. Everything that we got from them is semi-custom. So they have their designs that they're using in general for a mash tun and for a kettle, etc. But the orientation of the different components, where the boiler sits, where the grain outdoor is on the mash tun, all of those pieces they custom place by your specifications. And so we worked with our architect and ourselves to come up with where we're going to be putting all of the tanks, and then sent that sort of tank layout drawing to American Beer Equipment, and they came up with some of the ideas. Okay, well, we think if you're going to do that, then putting the grain door here would work, and you'll want the platform on this side. And so there was some back and forth to take what is a pretty standard item and make the little pieces of it fit properly for our building.
So you figure all that out, and you, is there any particular reason you decided to go with the folks out of Nebraska as opposed to anybody else?
we looked at several of the brewing equipment manufacturers. It was strictly financial.
Okay. Yeah.
Best bang for the buck.
Nice. So you put in your order. How long before your equipment was ready?
It really took somewhere in the 4 to 6 month kind of lead time for them to build all the equipment up for us.
And how does something like that like come to be? Like, do they just like UPS it? Like, what is that? Like, how did they all get here and get in place?
So the long story?
Longish, sure.
Okay, so ABE is using majority Chinese steel.
Okay.
So a lot of the tanks have been rolled, pressed pieces built in China.
Okay.
That are then shipped here to Lincoln, Nebraska, where it's then assembled in the States and then taken back apart and shipped here. Mostly, some of the pieces are more coming directly from China. Our fermenters and bright tanks, those were manufactured at the facility in China and come like as is. And then ABE, as necessary, hires local welders to fix any issues with the steel that came out of China. And then the pieces with more moving parts, the kettle and the mash tun, and all the things that have the pneumatics and motors and things attached to them, they build it in Nebraska and test everything there and break it back down and ship it here. So it comes on a big freight truck and requires a rigging company to help you unload it.
And then do you have to put it together? Did you, like, the rigging company comes in and they put all these big heavy things together, and then there's lots of things that need to hook together.
Yes. So, yeah, Cody Crane, the local rigging company, came the same day that the trucks from ABE showed up. And they basically unload it, and they've got a couple of forklifts, and they have their methods of tilting things upright because most of the tanks ship on their sides.
Okay.
And so they get them off of the truck and into the building and where you want them.
Okay.
And then from there, you still have to move them. They get them mostly where you want them. But from there, we still had to take the pallet jack, and you know, they're not that heavy when they're empty. And so
right.
A pallet jack can move them around. And then you get them exactly where you want them, and they have leveling feet, so you got to get them all really level. But then from there, they require a glycol circulation so that they're individually chilled tanks.
Right.
So we had to have a mechanical engineering company hook up the glycol, and we had to have an electrician hook up all of the glycol relays of the solenoids that tell the glycol whether or not it ought to be on or off. And then we actually also, for our serving tanks, because we serve right out of the tanks, but they're chilled tanks in a warm room. So we have a glycol chilled tank in a warm room that's full of cold beer that is carbonated and needs to move only about 20 feet across the wall to where our tap lines are in the bar. But in that time, the beer line that's leading there, that needs to be actively chilled or all the CO2 breaks out of suspension. So we also had to install all of the what they call a glycol trunk line, which is what the beer travels through one and a glycol loop travels through it so that it's being chilled in route.
And so they do the glycol, but do you have to actually like hook everything else up yourself? Is there an instruction manual? Like,
there are instruction manuals. ABE sends a representative out to help
okay.
you. Yeah.
That's
yes, there are people around to help you, and you know, they'll stick through your first couple of brews as much as you need them to.
That sounds much better than IKEA furniture.
It's a step above IKEA furniture, yes.
they send like a little person like, here you go. You can also bring
Wouldn't it be great if IKEA did that?
I know. They're like, but they wouldn't fit in a flat box.
No, right. No. Yeah. And then you'd still have to translate it from Swedish.
Probably. Well, amazing. Okay, so now we've got everything in here and it's time to actually brew beer.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide on your ingredients and how you're gonna go about that? I know that you were a home brewer before.
Yep.
So you had some experience.
Yeah, I was a home brewer before, and I was a professional brewer before. So I had already done plenty of work in scaling my own recipes mm-hmm. from the homebrew side up to a full 7-barrel batch scale. So we were pretty familiar with what we needed to be doing to translate our homebrew recipes into pro brew recipes. And we just had, we opened with 6 beers on tap. So we really just had to pick what those first 6 beers were going to be out of our dozens of right. available homebrew recipes.
How many different places can you get malt?
A lot. We have, right here in Maine, we have 2 local maltsters, the Maine Malt House and Blue Ox Malt House. And then we buy a lot of Thomas Fawcett's English malts. We really like the Thomas Fawcett Golden Promise as a base malt. We use a good bit of that. We use a Belgian Pilsner malt a lot. We use some German, Vienna, and Munich malts. It really depends on the beer that we're making, where we're going to be sourcing our grain.
So is there like a catalog where you can just like flip through? Are there 15 catalogs? Is there like some dealer that comes with a trench coat? Like, how do you figure out where to actually, like, I know this is like brewer stuff and you all brewers know this, but as me as a beer geek, like, how do you find out about all these different places that you can get malt from?
We ask our friends a lot. We have a very friendly community of brewers here in Maine. So if we're looking for a supplier for something specific, it's really easy for us to just ask Nathan at Rising Tide,
right.
like, hey, where do you get your rice hulls the cheapest?
Yeah.
And they'll always be really happy to share that kind of information.
So is it like a catalog, though, once you get like in with a company or?
Yeah, we're using 2 other than when we buy directly from the Maine maltsters.
Right.
There are 2 pretty big companies that we can go through who wholesale the ingredients for brewing. And some of them are more focused on malts. Some of them are more focused on hops. We have a couple of suppliers who are focused strictly on hops and a couple who are doing a little of everything.
So now I have heard with hops where like they actually like come in with like a briefcase and there's hops in there. And there is that a true thing?
There's a guy with a briefcase full of hops?
I think so.
We haven't had him.
No?
He hasn't come by. No.
Maybe
I'd like to meet him.
Maybe I'm just like making my own story up in my head. Like, this is how I picture. I picture a guy with a trench coat coming in and showing you all of his malt. And then
right.
a guy with a briefcase.
We've had Paul Allard from Willamette Valley Hops. We buy a lot of our hops from them. He's come with a like big book that Barth Haas, which is a major hop what would you call them? Processor.
Okay.
In the States. They have a big book of all of these like very specific flavor wheels and all of the statistics of what you might be getting out of a given hop. And so you could go through their whole big book and say, I want a hop with this level of alpha acid and I want flavor profiles that are going to turn out like this when I use it for dry hopping. And they can really help you get through a lot of all of that with their great big binder full of hops.
So is there any scratch and sniff in there? Because that would help me a lot.
No scratch and sniff stickers, but they will send you samples.
Oh, well, that's almost as good as
yeah.
scratch and sniff. I feel like if we could get a little bit of scratch and sniff stickers in there, that would be like...
That would be cool. You can get the like jelly beans.
Wait, what?
There's a couple of companies that make jelly beans or candies that taste like different hops.
Really?
Yeah.
I've only ever heard, so I'm a Harry Potter geek, so I've only ever heard of like the all flavor jelly beans.
Yep.
And those ones scare me.
Yeah, they're pretty gross.
Yeah. but I think that would be fun, like having hop jelly beans.
Yeah, I've never, the jelly beans I've had, I think have all been off flavors of beer, but there are like hop candies that are derived from the oils of saaz or... Centennial.
I have heard like the hard candies.
Yes. Yeah.
But these jelly beans, they really intrigue me.
I might have misspoke. I'm not sure that they have specific hop jelly beans, but I did get a packet of like beer off flavor jelly beans.
I still want those.
So if you
too.
Want a diacetyl jelly bean, there's a company that'll sell that to you.
I want to know
tell
what
you
that
right
is.
Now, you don't want a diacetyl jelly bean.
No. Bill's over here pulling down some wort, and he's no.
Diacetyl jelly beans.
I am going to put Justin, our show note writer, on a mission to actually
find you the jelly beans.
I would like you to add a link to the show notes, Justin, for these jelly beans. Well, thank you very much. Today has been great. We will definitely at least have the Facebook story and some video of this for today's brew day. And thank you very much for joining me on mic.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for coming.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So make sure you go over and check out the show notes. There's a lot of breweries that we talked to, a lot of different things. This is probably a shorter episode.
Yeah.
Maybe
you
it's a long...
Maine, Mass.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
Did you wash that? Did you wash it out?
People, when I was growing up, called me Mander. They'd get rid of the A and add an R. And
that's typical of the land out here in the east. I almost said west.
The beast?
It's in the beast of the east. It was where they say Amander.
Not Amander, it's just Mander. You got to get rid of the A.
I like E-M-Mander. N-Mander. Amander.
So as I was saying, go over and check out the show notes, greatbeeradventure.com/podcast. And I don't know what we're bringing you next week because I have been at a beer festival. Come on, guys.
Something exciting. Something explosive. Something that's going to knock their socks off and their beer koozies off.
I hope it's not explosive.
In a good way. Not like things that are not good.
Yeah. Those things that are not good are not good.
Oh, good things.
Right. Anyway. Exactly. So listen in next week for whatever the heck we're going to bring you. And until then, go out there and try something new. Cheers, friends.
Cheers. Enjoy your beers.